You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Raphael Rubinstein. He is a New York-based poet and critic whose numerous books include Polychrome Profusion, which is Selected Art Criticism, 1990 to 2002, The Afterglow of Minor Pop Masterpieces. He also edited the anthology Critical Mess, Art Critics on the State of Their Practice. He has numerous other publications, many articles, and he's currently professor of critical studies at the University of Houston. Raphael, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for inviting me to talk to you.
I know you're writing from the Brooklyn Rail and other places. What is it that you're currently working on or involved in at the moment?
What I'm working on now is I'm writing a monograph on the painter Shirley Jaffe, who is an American painter who's been living in Paris since 1949. She's one of the generation of Americans who went to Paris just after World War II. She's still there, 90 years old, working well, very active. And finally, there's going to be a book covering her entire career, and that's really what I've been immersed in. I'm hopefully getting towards the conclusion of this, but I've really been immersed in the history of one artist and how she's been involved in various moments throughout the last 50 years.
That sounds fascinating. Yeah, it's interesting.
They're actually, by coincidence, is a show of Jaffe's paintings from the 1970s at Tibor Denage Gallery that's on now in New York.
So a monograph is of course quite different than a critique, you know, and I think I want to talk a little bit about Critical Mess and some of your perspectives on criticism and how it evolves. I've talked to Dave Hickey, and I've talked to Arthur Danto, I mean, as well as David Ross, but he isn't a critic. But both of those critics, Hickey and Danto, have quite different approaches. And Danto, I wouldn't say is the kind of critic that really, you know, battles it out with artists in the theater bar, as you said, so to speak. But I think is coming from a philosophical point of view.
That's certainly true. I mean, I'm so sorry that Arthur Danto passed away recently, and it is a great loss. And it's true that Danto came to criticism from philosophy, but he also had long experience in the art world and had made art himself. And, you know, he wasn't someone coming from a completely different perspective. But I had an interesting debate, I guess you could call it, with Danto about the role of the critic. And one of the points that we disagreed with was Danto believed that it made no sense at all to compare different artists, to compare one artist with another and to evaluate them in some kind of hierarchical way. And I felt very differently. One of the things that we disagreed with, I had made a comparison between the work of Bryce Marden and Joan Mitchell, and I found Mitchell's work had so much more to offer me as a viewer and as a critic than Marden's. And Danto said that that made no sense to him, and that he felt that each artist was really so distinctive in doing something quite different that it wasn't, for him, wasn't something that he tried to do as a critic. I mean, what he was trying to do as a critic writing for The Nation was really to interpret works and present them to the readers and not be involved with making any kind of value judgment, though he was making implicit value judgments by the work he selected to write about. And it's true that value judgments are harder and harder to find in contemporary criticism, at least in print publications and mainstream media. And it's also true that there are a lot of reasons for being suspicious and skeptical about that kind of value judgments that once were the stock and trade of art critics.
Well, I guess it's the type of value judgment. Isn't Jerry Saltz also in the business of value judgments?
He is, and he is, I guess, when there are a few exceptions, and I think that the exceptions would be Jerry Saltz and the critics in the New York Times. But in contrast to art magazines, most art magazines, which seem less and less committed or interested in that kind of criticism.
I think Jerry Saltz seems to hold out almost a different kind of a value judgment or paradigm. He has an enormously active Facebook page, and as we all know, and seems to engage artists, but also can be beyond what I would say is a value judgment. Can be quick to make almost a personal judgment, which isn't historically uncommon with critics, to kind of take an artist to task or to have a terrific joke at the expense of an artist. I mean, this is also part of value judgments. Do you think that's fair game?
I think one of the problems that critics have grappled with, and that I was trying to address in my anthology, Critical Mess, is if you're going to make these kinds of judgments, and what is it's on what basis? Like, how do you determine and articulate the values of art that you are using to say that one artist is successful or one artist is not successful? And that's, I think that as there more and more of the kind of reception and discourse around art has to do with money and market and auctions and the economy, it's harder and harder for critics, and also more imperative for critics, to find some grounding that's not just a question of personal taste, and to really try to look at things in a bigger picture. And I don't know that Facebook really is offering that much to the future of criticism, but on the other hand, I do think that the bright spots of criticism, a lot of them, the current bright spots, have to do with technology. And I do think that the what's possible with blogging, and even to some degree with social media like Facebook, is opening up a lot of new territory for criticism. And I think that one of the things that's changed is the role, or the absence of, the disappearance of the role of the editor. I just published a piece, a sort of memoir, in the new issue of Art Papers, the art magazine published from out of Atlanta. And this is an issue that's guest edited by Dusko Petrovic, and it's about art magazines. And my piece, which is called Other People's Prose, is a sort of memoir of my years working as an editor of art magazines, Flash Art and Art in America, for a long time. And one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot is how what's the role of the editor in relationship to the critic, and the kinds of revisions and challenging questions that editors are historically present their writers with. When you're writing for a blog or you're making a post on Facebook, there's you're absolutely free, which is has a lot to offer, you know, to be able to say what you want without someone telling you, no, you can't print that, or are you really sure that you want to make that statement, and kind of giving you chances to dial it back. So there's this kind of, it's a new territory, I think, and it may be a new kind of writing without the editor. But what I worry that might get lost is that deepening of one's thought and the reflection and the kind of trying to build up your position and your argument in a much stronger way and not sort of off the cuff, and is that possible to do without that dialogue between the editor and the writer? But it could be that maybe this is not the way people were thinking about things right now, and it's not the kind of writing that makes sense to readers, and it maybe is. In my piece, I say that there's like an interesting parallel between the disappearance of the psychoanalyst and the disappearance of the editor. It's this that kind of very personal relationship and dialogue over a long period of time. Things are operating so much faster now.
Do you think that occurs in part because of the rising role of commerce in art? When I spoke with Dave Hickey, he thought that the reason art criticism had changed and wasn't very critical or casting any value judgments in the major art publications is because the advertising department was talking more to the editorial department, even if that's unspoken and previously taboo, that he felt that it's not good for the business of art magazines who are struggling for revenue right now.
I mean, that might have something to do with it, though. Well, when I worked at Art in America for a long time, there was a very, very thick firewall between editorial and advertising, which didn't, however, mean that the magazine was filled with a lot of negative criticism.
Do you think that firewall still exists?
I don't know, actually. I'm not working at the magazine or not working as an editor at any magazine now. I really can't say. But I think that Hickey maybe touches on another issue or points in the way of thinking about another thing, which is transparency. And as people have been saying, I guess, in the wake of the massive auctions last week, that the art market is the most unregulated, least transparent economic zone of activity in the world now, probably. And I think it would be great to see, at a moment when money is so important, rather than thinking, well, we've got to, as critics, be able to, you know, retain or regain our independence and not be influenced by the art market. But maybe what really is more would be more interesting, and maybe it's not something for critics to do, is a kind of investigative criticism or investigative journalism, and trying to introduce more transparency. I mean, maybe we need like a WikiLeaks for the art world. And I'm certainly I'm not someone who has the skills or ability to do that, but I think that in some ways might be more pressing, and kind of there's more work to be done in that direction, or as much work to be done in that direction as in the thread of...
It's true. That's a fascinating idea to have a type of investigative criticism, so to speak, where the transparency that we're after would be revealed apparently by the numerous connections between museum directors, trustees, private collections, auctions. I mean, that's what we're talking about. Is that correct?
Well, exactly. Just the sort of thing that the artist Mark Lombardi was doing in the late 90s when he was making those amazing and revelatory drawings where he kind of followed the money trail through all kinds of international, global networks. And that's, there's a little bit of that going on. I think that William Paujita has tried to do some kind of investigative art in his satirical drawings.
Sure.
But things are not transparent, and one of the things I mentioned in my this piece in Art Papers is how no one has really... This is getting slightly off the subject, but no one's ever written a history of art criticism. And one of the aspects of art criticism that I think would be interesting to uncover is just how decisions are made in art magazines and in newspapers, and what was going on when Clement Greenberg was writing for the Partisan Review in the 40s, and what was the decision-making and the editing process there, or what goes on today with the New York Times. I think there's a need for more information, and maybe also if we understood better how things had happened in the past, it might clarify what's happening and how things happen now.
I think that is a very important topic and a book to be written hopefully soon by someone. It would be fascinating. Do you feel that critics play an essential role in an artist's career?
Absolutely. I think they do. And I think that, but there are different ways to think about this, because on the one hand, you go into a gallery and you see the folder on the desk, on the table, on the counter that gives you the whole history of the artist, then one of the important elements of that history is the bibliography, and it's usual for the gallery to keep track of every review and every article and every mention of the artist. And the message that is being conveyed by those bibliographies, which then also get transferred into exhibition catalogs, and museum catalogs. The message that's being made there is that this is an important artist because this artist has been written about many times and has a long bibliography. And just like the great artists of the past, and in some ways we determine who are the great artists of the past, they're the ones who have been written about the most, who are kind of continual focus for art history. So what I'm getting at here is, and when I'm in a more cynical moment, is I worry that the value of the critic is not so much in what she or he actually writes or says about the artist, but the mere fact of having published something that is going to fatten up the bibliography. And I think sometimes critics feel that. They feel that in the end it doesn't really matter what they say. It's just that those inches of print are appearing. Now, having said that, I also know from my relationships and dialogues with artists how incredibly important criticism is to artists and how much they actually expect and hope for and appreciate and need some real concrete and response from the critic. And, you know, critics can, one of the things critics can do is just put things into perspective, into historical perspective. And I think also because exhibitions are so ephemeral, the gallery show is there for a month, maybe a museum show for 2 months, maybe there's a catalog, maybe there's not a catalog, maybe there's some images you can look at online, but that, I think it's one of the tasks of criticism is to realize or to make concrete what the implications and actually the experience of the art is that lasts beyond the exhibition. And I've, as you said, I am a poet and critic, and I've recently been thinking a lot about what it is that poems do differently from criticism. What are poems about art or response to art? What can they do that you don't find so much in art criticism? And I think that one thing that a poem can do is actually be a lot more, be closer to one's actual experience of the artwork in the moment. Like, you know, when you're looking at a painting in a gallery, obviously you're looking at the painting and you're thinking about the painting and thinking about the artist, but you're also thinking about, you know, isn't it time for lunch? And did you turn off the light when you left your house? And who's that person who just came into the gallery? And, you know, all of these, and, you know, what you're going to do, you know, what's happening with your job. Your mind is filled with distractions, things that seem to have nothing to do with the work of art you're looking at. And what a poet can do is actually describe that, and you see that in, I think, some of Frank O'Hara's poems, for instance, describe that and convey that experience of looking at the work in a way that's so much more, so much truer to people's actual experience, whereas writing by art critics and art historians generally almost always leaves out all of those real-time distractions and sort of positions the work in some kind of ideal vacuum. And I think that, again, is one of the things that good criticism can do and, you know, something that maybe artists can artists appreciate is that, you know, what is the actual experience of looking at the work and not just what its art historical associations are or how it fits into the artist's development, but actually what goes on in that moment of looking and thinking and figuring out So, coming back to your question, what is, you know, about whether criticism is important to artists? I think that's one way it's important from a non-cynical point of view. And so I'm sorry.
Right. That to actually get it to talk about the experience, and I think through the lens of a poet is also something different in particular. I know John Yao is also a poet and a critic, and I don't know if some of that enters into his work, but in a way it's also quite different being from a critic's point of view. There are critics who have been artists and are no longer artists, and there are critics who are active artists, poets.
And some of the, I think some of the best critics are artists. And because I think artists understand things about art making that a non-artist will never understand in the same way. And I always say that I think one of the best critics of the mid-20th century was Donald Judd. And Judd supported himself as an art critic in the late 50s, early 60s, before his own career really took off. And he's an amazing, endlessly fascinating and revelatory critic, I think, and much more open-minded than one might think, because I think maybe Judd has this reputation as being very dogmatic and kind of hardcore minimalist. But if you look at the kinds of art he wrote about, he was very, very open to many different styles. But I think that when an artist makes that kind of commitment to write about art and considering the risks that sometimes entails, that I think is really, really valuable, and as valuable, maybe more valuable than when a poet or novelist is moved to write about criticism. I, for a long time, tried to keep my poetry and my art criticism separate. I didn't really write very many poems about works of art, and in my writing, I really tried to keep my writing kind of very plain and not involved in any kind of sensibility, and not reaching for some sort of fine writing effects. And for me, that just made sense and seemed necessary. But I, more recently, I guess I've started to change my thoughts, my feelings about the relationship between my poetry and my criticism, and I found myself writing more often poems in response to or about works of art, and also starting to experiment more in terms of style and structure in criticism. So, and I think that dialogue between the world of poetry and the world of contemporary art has a great history, of course, but I think is a place where I've really trying to put more attention recently. I did an anthology, a portfolio in the summer 2013 issue of Art in America. I don't know if you saw that. It's unfortunately not online. It's only in the print edition, but it does exist. And I did an anthology of poems, 12 poems written in response to contemporary art by contemporary poets. And one of the things I've been noticing in recent years is there are a lot of poets who really follow contemporary art pretty closely and often are writing in response to it. And I'm intentionally avoiding saying writing about the work, because I think a lot of the poems are not about so much. They're not trying to describe in the kind of more traditional ekphrastic poem manner, but they're really engaging in kind of from different, sometimes oblique, angles with the works of art that are the kind of jumping off point for these poems. So anyway, I noticed that there are a lot of poets like Mary Jo Bang, someone who comes to mind, one of the most important contemporary poets who's written a few years ago, published an entire book of poems about contemporary artworks from Sigmar Polka to Cindy Sherman to Bruce Pearson. So at the same time, I was having the feeling that there were not that many people in the art world who were aware of this activity in the world of poetry. And in fact, not that many people not that many artists or people in the art world who actually read poetry, especially compared to the situation maybe 50 years ago, when there were these very close personal and artistic relationships between poets and painters. So what I'm hoping to do with this anthology is to reopen those lines of communication between the art world and the poetry world. And there certainly are. I mean, I'm not saying that they don't exist at all, and there certainly are plenty of poets and painters, poets and artists who've been doing things, collaborations together. For instance, Charles Bernstein and Amy Silman have done some really amazing collaborations recently with poetry and painting and video. And so I feel like that could be the poems being written around contemporary art could be a source of new energy for criticism, and maybe that might address the kind of discontent of that Dave Hickey is expressing about criticism not being as strong or forceful or authoritative as it has been in the past. And and maybe one of the problems is it needs to have some kind of be based on different kinds of perceptions and different kinds of intentions and different kinds of dialogues, rather than the 50-year-old argument between the kind of formalists and the anti-formalists, between the academic art historians and the poet journalist critics.
I think also in terms of the use value of it for artists in particular, the idea of poetry being written and really having this very kind of intimate experience with their art would be enormously valuable in terms of the feedback you were talking about and the importance of that, as opposed to whether they simply like it or not. What artists want to know is, what was your experience with it, really?
Yes, and does it make something happen? What does art do? What, apart from being exhibited and bought and sold, maybe, and reproduced, studied by students, but what actually, what is its effect in the world? And one of its effects certainly could be a poem.
Absolutely. I'd like to talk a little bit about how you got involved in this world of art. As a growing up, were you surrounded by art, or was there something like that?
I wasn't particularly surrounded by art. I wasn't. It's not that I never went into a museum, though I probably, let's say, I probably almost never went into an art gallery growing up. I studied literature in college, and when I first came to New York in the late 70s, I think I was really affected by and interested in. The two worlds that really interested me most were music and visual art. But I had no intention for quite a while of being an art critic. I think very, very few people actually say they're going to write art criticism when they grow up. I don't have a background in art history, but there were some really key moments as I look back on it that I guess planted the seeds for my eventual activity as an art critic. And when I was 17 or 18 years old, I was backpacking around Europe, and I was in London, and I went into the old Tate Gallery, and still is now in the new Tate, but in the old Tate there was a room of paintings by Mark Rothko, and I walked into this space and something strange happened to me. It was as if I couldn't leave. There was some sort of invisible force field that held me there. I sat down on a bench and probably spent half an hour or an hour just absorbing Rothko's paintings. And I really date my interest or awareness of the power of art to that moment. But in some ways fell into art criticism in the way that, sort of old-fashioned the way I think a lot of people in the 40s and 50s did, like critics like Harold Rosenberg and Clement Greenberg. And the one thing that was different about my beginnings is I began writing collaboratively with a friend of mine, a sculptor, Daniel Weiner, and we actually, for the first year of my criticism, it was all written as a collaborative team.
This time, you're also writing poetry, so you're developing as a poet as well. Is that correct?
Yes, that's true. I was always writing poetry, and I suppose in the beginning maybe my criticism was closer to the poetry, and I guess as my critical voice developed, I was able to do the things I needed to do as a critic. And that were different from what I was doing as a poet. I think for me also what was really crucial, a number of things. One is my experience working as an editor at art magazines. I think really for one thing it was just the kind of craft and attention of writing and in particular, Art in America, there was this, which the way that the magazine was run by Betsy Baker when I started working there really had its roots in the art news of the 1950s. And with the really incredible attention to accuracy and subtlety of interpretation, and also being prepared both as an editor and a writer to keep on revising and rewriting until something was perfect. And that really, for me, was a big part of understanding how criticism actually worked and how it doesn't, how sometimes it doesn't work.
Right, that makes sense. I mean, as a poet too, what sometimes an analogy that comes to me when I hear writings, often not by artists, but sometimes where we're hearing about the the difficulty of surviving in New York as an artist, why artists aren't more supported, how we have to move further and further out into Brooklyn on a train. And, you know, David Byrne wrote that article. There's been, there's always seems to be talk about that, more support of the art. And sometimes I think, you know, poets would never make this argument, right? We're all artists, whether you're a poet or a visual artist. And why is it that poets don't make that kind of argument? Now, we know that poetry doesn't have the same kind of value in the marketplace as visual art, but it clearly has the same cultural value as the art, as the visual art. Why isn't that argument made, and why do poets seem to accept what would appear to be a, and correct me if I'm wrong or comment on this anyway, but a different set of aspirations than visual artists have?
I think one thing that happened and contributed to the divide between poetry and art is that poets began to support themselves more and more exclusively in academia, teaching in creative writing programs scattered all around the country. And whereas there used to be these bohemian enclaves, neighborhoods where poets and painters lived side by side and went to the same bars and kind of didn't have, and whose expectations and lifestyles weren't really very different, as that really changed, probably in the 60s, when everything seemed to change, right, that more and more the poets are anchored in and relying on academia. And though there's certainly plenty of artists who teach and who've left major cities for teaching jobs, I think it's much more common for that to happen with poets. And so that, and I think that was one of the key issues that began to create this divide that I'm talked about, what I'm trying to stitch back together in some, at least in some virtual way. They are very different, but I think those differences, sometimes can lead to frustrations and misunderstandings, but also that those differences are can be really inspiring and enlightening for both sides. For an artist to be in dialogue with a poet who has such a completely different set of conditions and needs can be interesting. And I think that there are, there are poets who become artists and artists who become writers. I think about a number of artists who began as poets. Marcel Borders is one example. Vito Acconci, Carl Andre began writing poems, which have been recently rediscovered. And then you look at a poet like Kenneth Goldsmith, who began as a sculptor, a visual artist, and migrated into the world of poetry and is brought into the world of contemporary poetry, a lot of ideas and procedures and approaches from the art world, which has been very, very interesting to watch. So I wonder whether it might be interesting to actually try to bring something from the world of poetry into art. And I mean, maybe that might even have something to do with as an economic model, though I would God forbid that anyone should use poetry as an economic model for anything. But
well, but that was certainly said about art at one point, wasn't it? It's certainly probably pre-60s. The idea of art as an economic model was thought of the same way as poetry now. And I'm not saying that's how it should be, as you say, stitched back together. But you know,
it's true. And if you look at the economy of poetry in early 19th century England, that and you read about the expectations and poets like Byron and Shelley and Coleridge. I mean, they were in some ways the kind of celebrity and fame and instant success that we associate with contemporary art was actually happened a lot in the realm of romantic poetry. So maybe at some point in the past, or some points in the past, their lines have crossed and might cross again. But I think that for a long time, when artists and critics and thinkers about art have been looking outside of art for ideas and sources and frameworks, they've been looking a lot to philosophy. You know, the whole long dominance of postmodernist, post-structuralist philosophy, which still continues to quite a big extent, but I think that maybe it's time to look in another direction, and you know, find connections not to philosophers but to poets.
Mm. Yeah, I love that notion. That's a wonderful kind of realm to reach for, I think,
and also a realm I think where we don't know where it would lead. I mean, in some ways, we already understand very well the back and forth between visual art and philosophy. And even if you change the set of philosophers or generations of philosophers you're reading, like it, so instead of Foucault and Derrida, you're reading Jacques Rancière and Slavoj Žižek, their ideas may be different, but there's something about the structure that and the flow of ideas that doesn't really change. And I feel like with poetry, because it is so fundamentally different activity and experience, that might, who knows what it might do. I mean, but that not knowing is maybe what would make it less academic.
I think so. I think that holds out a very interesting possible paradigm notion or even historical shift. It's been really lovely talking to you. I really enjoyed this very much. This interview is reaching a lot of artists, writers, all different kinds of people who are not just beginning their careers, but in the middle of their careers. In closing, is there anything you want to say in particular to artists who are listening and perhaps have different ideas of what the role of the critic might be? Certainly we've fleshed out a lot of ideas during this talk about how artists perceive the critic and the different types of critics. Is there anything you want to say about that interaction between artist and critic that to these listeners who are with us today?
I think all I would say is that try the experiment of reading fewer art magazines and going to more poetry readings, and see if that is inspiring and fruitful. Other than that, I'll leave it there.
Thank you so much, Rafael. I'm really grateful for your talk today, and thank you for being on our show.
I enjoyed it. Thanks a lot.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.